I'm passionate as an athlete, I'm passionate as an entrepreneur, but I'm also very passionate about this community and about something we call the spirit of speed golf. Competition is important, but we all want each other to perform at our best. We all want each other to win in the strangest way. Like whoever wins, we all win. I just want everyone to know that this is a really special community that is one that I'm fostering and nurturing. It's not one that I created. It's one that was created many, many years ago, but it's very special what we have. And I'm very thankful to be a part of it and to have the opportunity and to have the influence that I have in this sport.
Welcome to this episode of the Wild Golf Podcast. I am your host, Michael McDonald. We are continuing on the speed golf theme this week with Scott Dolly from Houston, Texas. Scott is an athlete, entrepreneur, pioneer, and coach, and the founder of Speed Golf USA. But at his heart, Scott is a speed golfer. We follow his up and down journey from golf phenom in high school to mini tour golfer to entrepreneur and husband and father. We finish up with Scott's speed golf exploits, winning the U.S. Championships in 2020 at the age of 42, and setting the speed golf world record in the U.S. Championships just a few weeks ago. Scott has been on an amazing journey, and there is much more to come from this man who has a vision for getting speed golf into the Olympics by 2040. I hope you enjoy this discussion as much as I did. So Scott, welcome to the Wild Golf Podcast. It's great to finally have you on.
It's great to finally be here, guys. Thanks so much. I know we took a shot at it a couple months ago and missed the bow, but here we are, and I look forward to our conversation.
So you're in Houston, Texas right now, is that right?
That's right, yeah. Born and raised and pretty much been here my whole life.
And did you grow up in a golfing sport family?
My dad was big into golf. I think that's a pretty common story for a lot of golfers, but he used it for business. He enjoyed it himself. And really one wonderful thing was that even at a young age, when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, he would wake me up early in the morning on Saturday mornings when he's going out to play with his buddies, and he would bring me along. It's not really necessarily something that I asked to do, but I just very slowly, started falling in love with it.
And did you play other sports as well growing up?
I played all kinds of sports. I kind of, one of the skills that I have is I can pick something up and do it well pretty quickly. So for me, I loved basketball growing up. I have an older brother who's 4.5 years older. So, that's just old enough to not be able to beat him at anything, but to have to try really hard. So, I played basketball, football, baseball, lacrosse, track and field, all kinds of sports growing up.
And at what point did you figure you wanted to focus on golf?
So that was in high school. I played my freshman year. So I had a little bit of pressure on the football side because my brother and my dad were both high school quarterbacks. They both set records at their high schools. I went to the same high school as my brother. And so I felt this kind of familial pressure, right? Paternal pressure to get out there and be a quarterback, be a varsity quarterback and try to break the records. But I started having a lot of success in golf, and I really started to enjoy golf competition at my sophomore year. That was probably what I was 15 years old. And it was interesting because, I told my dad and my brother I was going to drop everything and I was interested in just pursuing golf. And I mean, we had to have a sit down in the living room, and are you sure you want to do this? So, but what's interesting about that is that since then, enough time has gone by where there's been all of these issues with helmets and hitting and football injuries. My dad was actually hurt his knee in high school football. He's and he hasn't had a limp, but he's always had struggles with his knees. So you talk to him today and he'll say, Scott, I think that was the best decision you ever made. But back then he generally was like, are you sure you want to do this? So
there's always some good revisionist history I'm going on.
Right, sure. right. Exactly. Yep. Yep.
And so you played golf in college. So where did you go to college, and around what period did you play in college?
Yeah. So 95, 96, I was out there playing in big tournaments and figuring out where I was going to go. I was very fortunate at a young age. My dad, when I told him I wanted to play golf, he loved it, of course. So He helped me get lessons. We were members at a golf course here in Houston called Lochinvar Golf Club, where Butch Harmon was the director of golf for many years. And so I actually grew up taking lessons from Butch Harmon. And so that's how, you know, I really got the basics of my swing with Butch. But anyways, Butch Harmon knew Bob Rotella. I don't know if you know who Bob Rotella is.
Yeah, of course.
Sports psychologist. And so Bob Rotella and I started working together in high school. I flew up to Virginia and stayed with him in his home in the basement. And we went out to his golf course. And it's just, after I met with him, I started winning everything. It was awesome. I mean, it was just a totally different way to play the game. And he really arranged my brain properly and helped me do that. So that in competition, I was just, you know, at peak performance. So Bob Rotella knew Puggy Blackman. Puggy Blackman was Stuart Sink and David Duval's coach at Georgia Tech. And Puggy was moving to South Carolina. And so this was my junior year, moving into my senior year of high school. So actually, Rotella hooked me up. Dr. Bob hooked me up with Puggy Blackman. I went up there, went on a scouting trip. Really loved it, really enjoyed it. Of course, I was taking the lead of these two, you know, really important men in my life. And so I pulled the trigger early in my senior year. Actually, I was one of the first people to commit to a university. And I went to South Carolina in 1997, the fall of 1997, University of South Carolina. And it was a top 15 team at that point.
At this stage of the interview, we discuss how things very quickly went off the rails at the University of South Carolina.
The only problem was I was like six states away from my parents and any type of accountability. And so it's crazy because you go back and think about it now and you're like, how stupid can one person be? But, you know, my dad had just invested so much of his time, energy, effort, money in setting me up for success. And I went off to college and it's just like, I wanted a party. And so that became important to me. And the golf suffered. And so, but I remember doing training sessions, you know, basically running the stadium there at South Carolina, which seats like 80,000, but we'd wake up at 4:30 in the morning and I'd show up late after being out at night and just, you know, bad scenes ensuing there. But, you know, unfortunately, yeah, you know, I think it is a part of my story and it's unfortunate that it is, but at the same time, I think I've come out the other side, a better person for it. But, you know, at the age of 18, I just really wasn't mature enough to handle being in college and not having accountability. And so what began as just fun and partying in college actually ended up at the end of that year, me failing out of school my freshman year, and then me not being invited back onto the South Carolina golf team. And so that was really unfortunate. And realized I started to develop a addiction and a problem. And so I had to go back to summer school that year and I got all A's because I was like, I got to get out of here. And I was going to go back to SMU. So my second year, I went to Southern Methodist University. This is 98, 99. And I decided, you know what? I'm not playing golf. I'm just going to party. So like I doubled down on the partying. What am I thinking? So that was a really bad, that was actually, doubly as worse because I had nothing now holding me back and nothing restraining me. Anyways, it just became this big, big dark hole that I was going down. And, but I wanted to be in control of my life and that's kind of where it led. At the end of my second year at SMU, I remember waking up one day and looking in the mirror and just being like, who are you? I don't even know who you are. I don't even know what you've become. And so it was at that point that I just heard a voice to my head say, you need to talk to your dad. And that was the last person I wanted to talk to about the fact that it's now my second year in college. I'm going to fail out again. And after all of this money that you spent on my college, I have nothing to show for it. So anyways, it was the toughest phone call to make, but I did make it. And of course, my dad was amazing. And, you know, the first thing out of his mouth was, Scott, I love you. I want to help you. I think you should come home to Houston. And I think he said, I've got a business partner that goes to AA and I think you should go. And at that point I was like, okay, I've given like running my life 2 years, you know, a chance for 2 years and it's not worked out well. So I'm going to take his advice. And I did. I came home to Houston. I actually transferred for the second time now in 3 years. I transferred to U of H and I started going to AA. And I actually had my last drink of alcohol on my 21st birthday. So that would have been June 6th, 1999 was the last time I drank alcohol.
At this point of the interview, we discuss how Scott got his life back on track after returning to Houston.
So I came home to Houston and I got sober. I was clear-minded. I hadn't been that way in years. And what's the first thing I wanted to do? I wanted to go out and play golf. And I got back out on the golf course. I got back out there with my dad that summer. And it wasn't too long later when I just said, you know what, Dad, I think I'm going to call the U of H golf team and see if I can just walk on. And I had a buddy, you know, in Houston who was familiar with Coach Dirks. And he just said, man, Coach Dirks, like, you can't even get a hold of him. And if you can, he doesn't let anybody walk on. And I was just determined, man. I was inspired and determined. And so I called him for like 2 weeks straight. And finally, after 2 weeks, he called me back and I said, hey, let me take you out to Lochinvar and let's go play. And I just love the opportunity to play for you, sir. And he said, all right, let's go to Lochinvar. So we went out there and I remember, I think I doubled like the second hole and made a bogey on the third hole. I was 3 over through 3 and I was like, this is not going good. But I shot even par the rest of the way around. And he called me about a week later and that summer and just said, hey man, we've got a spot for you on the team if you want it. And so for me, that was just like a huge, you know, relief and a huge step forward out of the mess that I was coming out of. And it was great to get back on a golf team.
And then maybe you could talk a bit about your journey, both in life and golf after your college years.
So by the time I got to my senior year and it was clear I wasn't going to be the number one player on the team and I wasn't going to be winning any national titles, you know, my focus really shifted to wanting to graduate and just get it over with. And so I had become an English creative writing major because it was really the only thing I could do that I enjoyed doing. I had tried business admin my freshman year, and as you know, it didn't go so well. So for me, it was like reading and writing. I can do that to graduate. And so I really focused on that, focused on getting all my classes done. And about that time, I met a girl on a golf course. And we started hanging out and we became really fast friends. And little did she know, but like the instant I saw her, I knew she was my wife. And, but you know, I wanted to do it right. So we became friends and it wasn't more than, you know, 3-4 months later that we professed our love for each other. And so it was also at that time that I really, since I had sobered up, I really wanted to develop my spiritual life. And so I really went searching for God in that time. And she was really kind of the final piece of the puzzle for me. And so, you know, I became a Christian in college my senior year, which is, you know, I'm very thankful for. And we decided we wanted to share that message. And so when we graduated from college, she graduated 6 months after me. And then we got married 3 months after that. And this was in 2003, in March of 2003. And we went into full-time Christian ministry for like a couple years. And it was wonderful. It was a really great time. We got to help kids out. We decided to do youth ministry. And then the other thing we said was we weren't going to have kids for 5 years. We just wanted to be best friends and fall in love and be in love and have no other responsibilities and be able to travel, do whatever we want. So we did that. And about 2 years into full-time ministry, then we both really felt called to the marketplace. I felt called to pursue this lifelong passion I had of playing golf on the PGA Tour. That was still in my heart and it wasn't over yet. And I was in my middle 20s. And so I made the decision after a couple of years, I'm going to go raise some sponsorship and go out and try to get on tour. And so I was going to go play the mini tours. Well, Natalie, she's so industrious and just such an entrepreneur. She came out and she would go with me. She'd bring a box of jewelry that she bought here in Houston. And she would call all the little stores and all the little towns we were going to, because mini tours aren't held in big cities. Mini tours are held at the country clubs in small town, Louisiana and other places, you know, where it's the big event. And so she would call all the little shops around town and she would go bring her stuff. And she'd sell them on consignment. So she was staying busy. I was staying busy. It was a great time. I was on the mini tours. You know, my first professional event in 2005, I finished second and I thought I was going to win it. Some guy came in with a 64 and beat me by one, but I was like, I almost won my first pro event. But by the time the end of that year had come, the struggle of understanding how to be a traveling professional touring player had caught up with me. And so it's funny because at the end of that year, she made more money than I did, but we really enjoyed our time then. And we came home to Houston. This is 2006, 2007. And I wanted to stay around the game of golf. And so I got an assist. Actually, I started caddying and I did that for a while. And then I got an assistant pro job at Golf Club of Houston in 2007, where they had the Shell. And I met a lot of great pros that year. That was the year Adam Scott won, I think. And I was actually in the NBC production van while he was winning. It was so cool to see their TV array and all these people in there. And it was just incredible to watch. 2008, I ended up at Sienna Plantation Golf Club. After I started working with Butch, I started working with a different instructor, Neil Wilkins. And I went down to his golf course and was an assistant pro down there.
And now Scott's just about to turn 30, and naturally, he thinks about Q School.
And then something happened in 2008, and I was just like, I'm turning 30. I've got to go to Q School. I've never been to Q School. And so I talked to my wife, and like kind of our three-word motto since we've been married is go for it. You know, someone spoke that over our life, like, go for it. And so every time we come to a crossroads in life, we think about it, we pray about it, and we just say, what, you know, if we were going to go for it, which way would it be? Let's do that, you know, and it's worked out pretty well. But I talked to her about it and she said, go for it. You know, let's go out there. Let's go to Q School. So I got some money raised. I had a tournament. I had all my friends come. I raised enough money and I went out and I busted through first stage. I had about 3 weeks to prepare and I busted through first stage and I was in the final group and I got a little shaky on the final nine. And I was like, whoa, but now I'm on the next stage. I've got time to fix that. I went out and I shot 71, 70, 70. I'm in seventh place with one round to go. And I get to the back nine and I just blow it. And I end up missing it by two. And so that was the end of that journey. But I was like, I left it very proud because at some point in those eight rounds, I had discovered that I have all the pieces necessary to play on tour. And for me, that had to be enough at that point. It just had to be enough to be able to tell myself all the elements are in there and you haven't had the time to bring them out. But you're having a kid in 3 months and you got to get busy. You got to get a job, basically. <Yep. laughs> And I'm turning 30, right? Yeah. So,
and is this the point when you started working for Drive On Technologies or was that a little bit later?
It was, yes. I missed out on Q School. And I came back. My dad said, come over. I want to have a conversation with you. This is 2009. We're talking financial meltdown, that crisis, all that's going on. And my dad, so I was just like, yeah, I'm going to go get a job. And he was like, where are you going to get a job? You know, there's not a lot of jobs out there right now. But he said, look, Ryan and I, my brother, and he said, we're going to start a business, a financial services business. We'd love for you to be a part of it. And I was like, well, let me think about it, you know, but really I'm like, I'm in, man. So yeah. So I said, I'm in, guys, let's do this. And he said, okay, you need to write you have to write the business plan. You have to create the financial model for this financial services business. And we got to go raise $5 million. And I'm like, awesome, let's do it. So Ryan, my brother and I, we just worked so hard on this business plan for like 2-3 weeks. We got it in front of so many different investors and eventually we successfully raised $5 million. But it was a really great about three-year period of time because that's really where I kind of cut my teeth in becoming an entrepreneur. I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur, but I was still pursuing golf. And this was my chance to, you know, to work on marketing and to work on customer support and to work on back end and front end and side end. I mean, just do it all. You know what I mean? Have the executive positions, but then also be performing all of the individual roles as well.
At this stage of Scott's life, family, work, and Doritos intervene, but still he has a passion for golf in the back of his mind.
Unfortunately, over that 2-year, 2.5-year period, 3-year period of time at Drive On, I mean, there was a lot of Dr. Peppers, there was a lot of donuts, there was a lot of Doritos, and staring out the window, you know, and still just kind of having that dream of golf alive, but feeling like I can't do anything about it, you know? And also in that 3-year period of time, not only did we have our son Oliver in 2009, but in 2011, we had Elliot. And then in 2012, we had Amelia. And we've got 3 kids by then. And, you know, I'm pushing 200 pounds at this point. And I'm a starter. I'm a pioneer. I'm somebody that likes to start things. It gets me, I love being a part of something new, fresh, exciting. As long as there's something new to build, it's great. But once the systems, once the processes, once the engine is going, I tend to get a little bored. I started thinking about golf again, and I'm just like, Nat, I can't get this dream out of my heart. And so, yeah, here we are with 3 kids in 2012. And what happened was, I think this is an important part of the story, but what happened was I was unhappy with my physical appearance. I was unhappy with the fact that golf was not a part of my life. I wasn't unhappy with my life. It's not like I was going through a depression, but I just, something was missing. You know what I mean?
And you weren't golfing at all during the sort of those 2 or 3 years with Drive On and all the work and being an entrepreneur. That was, you wouldn't have had time for it.
The club basically in the closet. And I never thought I would be that person that said that, you know? So anyways, I was like, I've got to get motivated. I've got to get inspired in life. And I started looking for books, and I found one called Finding Ultra by a guy by the name of Rich Roll. And I recommend everybody get out and read that book first and then start listening to his podcast. I read his book and similar story. And so, and the thing that stuck out to me was how he changed his diet. And his wife was a very healthy eater, and he tried a vegan diet for a while. And I thought, you know what? I'm so sick of the way that I'm eating. I'm fine. I'm just going to make smoothies and eat salads for a month, and I'm going to see how I feel when it's over. That was like June 21st of 2012. I remember the day. And I stopped eating meat. I stopped eating cheese. I became a vegan that day, and nothing happened for like 2 weeks. And I'm like, this sucks. This doesn't even work. But over the next week, I lost 1 pound a day. And then over the next week, I lost, you know, another pound. I mean, I lost like 10 pounds in 2 weeks. And it was the energy that came back. I just had every day was a surge of energy. I had more energy than I needed, but at the same time, I could take a nap. Like, I could take a nap, or I can go run 8 miles. Like, either way is going to work, you know? And I never had that type of energy. My energy was always like, find a way to get the energy in, to get jittery, get excited, get going. But on this plant-based diet, this vegan diet, I just really felt amazing. And so I went from 197 all the way down to 157, and I was training. One of the things that I did to start training is because I had all this energy, and one night, you know, it was 10 o'clock at night and I couldn't sleep, and we got crying babies, and Nat said, Scott, put on your running shoes and go down to the bayou and just like go for a jog, get out of here. And so I did. And I went out and there was a full moon and I had my earphones in, and it, something hit me. And I'd never been a runner my whole life. And it was just immediately, I was like, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. This is amazing.
At the same point, Scott's inner voice calls him back to Q School.
To go back out on tour, I'm doing the whole fundraising and sponsorship again to get enough money to go to Q School. And 2013 rolls around. I'm in great shape. And I'm at work one day and I see a banner ad for the Speed Golf World Championships 2012. And I'm like, huh, what is that? And I click on it and it's running and it's golf. My lifelong passion, my newfound passion together in one sport. And I see these people like in these running poses on the golf course. And I'm like, wow, I cannot wait to try this. This is amazing. Right now I'm going to go make it on the PGA Tour, but I can't wait to try it. And so it was May of 2013. It was about 4 or 5 months later. I went out to Sharpstown Golf Course, May 25th or 6th or something of 2013. And I played my first round of speed golf. And it was dark on my first shot. I don't know where it went, but somehow I ran directly to it. And the sun broke on my second shot. It kind of, you know, the sky lit up. And I made a par on the first hole. And I hit a great chip on the second hole. And I'm breathing fast. And my mind's going a million miles a second. And it was just like, I felt like I got transported to back when I was 10 years old. And I felt like a kid. And so, you know, that was a really impactful moment in my life, was that 18 holes. And I finished the round in under an hour, and I shot, I don't know, 75 or something, which is, you know, whatever I normally shoot. And I didn't know what I was going to shoot. So, and I have a picture of myself. I grabbed some guy just walking by, and I was like, sir, here's my camera. I need you to take a picture of me. And I've got a picture of myself there after that first round. And scoot back a little bit, I had the chance to run into Chris Walker, who won the 2012 Speed Golf World Championships. I ran into him up in the Woodlands. I was playing in a money game with some other pros, and he was in it. And he also told me about speed golf, because I said, dude, I saw this banner ad. And he goes, yeah, I won that. And I was like, wow. And he said, look, Speed Golf International is running the show. There's a guy named Tim Scott. I'll get you in touch with him. There's an event coming up in June. It's called the Eastern Open. You should go. So I'm like, okay, so I'll try it. But first I got to go to Q school for the Canadian tour. So I did that. I went, I paid all this money. I go out there. There's 300 people trying to qualify for, like, I don't know, 40 spots or something. And it was at Moranga Canyon or something like that. It was out on the way to Palm Springs. I had the greatest warm-up session. My brother came out. He lived in LA at that time. He came out. We played 9 holes the night before. I birdied like 3 holes. And I was just ready to go. And the next day, the weather shifts. The wind picks up. And I end up shooting like 80 on the first day. And I'm like, it's over. I mean, it's already, I have 3 more rounds, but it's over. And so anyways, I kind of plodded through that and had dropped a bunch of money going there, and that didn't work. And then I came home to Houston, and there was a mini tour coming through town, and I dropped $1,400 on each one of those events, miscut. So here I am, I've raised $20,000 or whatever. I've gone through half of it, and I've still got 4 months to go to get to Q school. And I'm kind of freaking out, you know, I'm like, this is not good. It's kind of starting to feel like a really big failure here. And so I was like, Eastern Open, I'm going to call Tim. So I called Tim, and Tim's like, Scott, man, awesome that you're out there playing mini tours and whatever. And he goes, here's the deal. If you can get here, I'll get your hotel. I'll pay for your entry fee. There's going to be about 25 pros playing for $35,000. And I'm like, I'm playing against 100 touring professionals for $50,000. Like, I can't wait. So I went out. I finished 6th in my first professional speed golf event. And it was one of the hottest days of a speed golf event ever, probably rivaling 2019 here in Houston. What an amazing just experience getting immersed inside this community that's so open, so welcoming, so friendly. And Christopher Smith, you know, I got to meet him, and Tim Scott and Jim Kishelek, and a couple of other guys that are, you know, aren't part of speed golf anymore, but, and they were just so nice. And I thought, you know what? I found my people. I really felt like I'd found my people, and I found kind of like my purpose. And so that was a great event. And my next goal became, I'd like to get into the world championships. And so we went to Florida that summer for a family trip in 2013. We all hopped in the Sienna minivan and we drove over to Florida with 3 young kids. And I played in a couple, it was actually cheaper in Florida. You can play in 1 day and 2 day events for like $500. So I was like, yeah, I can make my money go twice as far. And I missed the cut. Like, I just was not performing. And so my last hole as a professional golfer was in Florida. It was the second day of a tournament. I shot 74 again. And I, you know, wasn't even close, wasn't going to make money. And I'd gotten to the point now where I would practice, and the practice rounds would be amazing, and my warm-up sessions would be amazing, but I would step up on the first tee and I would just not want to be there. And I would not, and I was dreading the next 4 hours or 5 hours. And so I hit my first shot and I spray it right into the clubhouse, and I re-tee again, and I duck hook it left into the grass, like 150 yards out, and walk up to the next shot. I take a 4-iron. I basically whiff it like 20 yards in front of me, and I just, something cracked in me. And I just looked over at my playing partners. I said, guys, I'm done. And I picked up the ball on the first hole there. And that was the last time I've ever played in a professional event, golf event.
So now, as an athlete, Scott's focus comes back almost exclusively to speed golf.
So I went out that year. We weren't at Bandon anymore. We were at Glen Club up in Chicago. in the second round of that year, I went out and played a round in 48 minutes. And I had six birdies and an eagle in that round. And I came to the final hole two under. I had bogeyed 17. I'd gotten to three under on 16, three putted 17. It was just ridiculous. So I'm two under and I'm like, I'm going to be the first person to shoot under par at Worlds. You know, I'm thinking this as I'm running down the fairway. I hit the best drive of the day, but it ends up in a tight position where I couldn't go for the green, which I thought, that's good though. It's a par five. It's going to make me lay up. It's going to force me to lay up. And so I laid up perfect. I hit a wedge to like 12 feet. And I'm like, if I make this, I shoot 69. And I gave it a little extra. And this was back in 2015. So I run around, I put my club down and it hits the ball and it moves the ball a little bit. And so I move it back. I putt it, it lips out and I end up making a double bogey and shooting even par. It was just like a massive disappointment. You know, I literally, I'm not kidding, for like over a year, every single night I would go to bed, I would think about that.
We jump ahead now a couple of years when things really start to happen for Scott's speed golf and his ambitions for the sport.
Moving into 2017, and I was like, I'm going for it. So I started Speed Golf USA in 2017 with the goal of organizing the sport of speed golf and being the governing body here in the US. And so that was my mission. And so it was, you know, things have been very slow. They've always moved at a very slow pace because I haven't injected a ton of money into it myself. And so that first year was just like making connections, getting a website up, letting people know I was out there, setting up a small fall series. We basically had like three or four events that year in the fall, which was really cool. And then planning for a first full tour series in 2018 that was going to be summed up at the World Championships, which we were going to have to host. And so I started Speed Golf USA. And at that time, I contacted these other national associations and I said, let's form the International Speed Golf Alliance. Let's just get that started. Let's work together. And instead of just having a small group of guys who are making the decisions for everybody, let's have these national associations who will eventually have boards and, you know, let's do that. Let's create the structure that we would want to see if we were an Olympic sport. That's the work I did in 2014. I did, you know, all the research to find out how do you become an Olympic sport? And I worked my way all the way back to the present moment. And I was like, okay, this is how we do it. And so that was my goal with ISGA, is to build out an organizational structure that all other Olympic sports had built out. And so we did that and we formed the ISGA in 2018 and we kind of announced it at the World Championships and we announced our what's called the 2040 Olympic vision. So we want speed golf to be either a format of golf in the Olympics or its own sport in the Olympics by 2040.
The Olympic goal, and we can talk a bit more about your vision at Speed Golf USA as well, but I mean, it seems to me too that speed golf is more natural and more pure for an Olympic sport than, say, a 72-hole medal tournament with professional golfers who are millionaires. Maybe I'm being sort of more of a purist about what Olympics should be, but I would always also say that about long drive. You know, if that would be a more pure Olympic sport than you know, professional tennis, professional golf, professional basketball, which is what part of it has become. I mean, what do you see as the, you know, the barriers and obstacles to it becoming an Olympic sport by 2040?
You know, I think you're right on the purist side, on just the pure athleticism and sports side. There's no question. It's a biathlon sport. I mean, it's like, it's two separate disciplines that you have to train at and learn how to bring together. I mean, what's more Olympic than that, you know, in terms of sports? I think that the biggest challenges are the political ones, are the ones that have to do with money.
Yes.
And
lobbying, you know, I mean, and greasing the wheels to get decision makers think about it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And that's a game that, to be honest with you, I don't like playing. I don't really want to do it. But I think, like, sometimes for the sake of certain things, you just kind of like realize you have to. And so that's an area where I feel like my role in the sport will move more towards that direction. Like right now, I still do the graphic design for my website, Right now, I still answer every single email. Right now, I still, you know, there's so many things that I'm still doing on the ground. And I feel like 2022 is going to be a year where we really, I'm able to start delegating. And I've got a passionate group of people here in the US that are willing to take on and shoulder some of that responsibility so that it frees me up to be going out to different shows and being going to trade shows and going out and meeting and greasing the wheels, you know. But that is the biggest challenge right now is we, you know, Olympic sports don't have to have mass participation. They don't. I mean, there's a lot of sports where there's probably 100 people in the world doing it. You know what I mean? Like, or 1,000 people in the world doing it. Not that many. So you don't have to have this mass participation in order to have legitimacy, but you do have to know the right people. And so I think that's going to be a big part of probably the last 10 years of the journey. However long it takes, the last portion for me, I think, is going to be that. It's going to be a lot of moving, traveling, speaking, engaging. And so I look forward to that time.
And apart from the vision for the Olympics by 2040, just thinking out in the next 5 years, what sort of vision do you have for what speed golf USA might look like by then?
Yeah, so I tend to think in terms of, I do think Speed Golf USA, and there are specifics there. I guess I'll stick with that. But I do tend to think about speed golf as a sport.
Internationally.
I understand that. Yeah. So we've standardized here in the US, we've standardized our tournament structure. And so we have standardized entry fees for every division. And we have a standardized point system that we were going to implement this year. And then the sponsor fell through, but we have it already built out, ready to go. So we can have a year-long points race. We've standardized the purses so that all the pros know when they come to an event, it's going to be X amount of dollars. And we're trying to get that now raised every year. So that's good. And I feel like that's a big part of my role right now and has been for the last 5 years, is to do all that like underground subterranean work where you're building the foundation of the sport. You know, it's something that most people will never see. Most people will never know the hours that I've put in to get all the different areas set up. But so the next 5 years, we're going to have a tiered tournament structure that will appear in the US and then eventually all over the world. So there'll be local events, there'll be state or regional events, and there'll be national events. All of them will have a different point ranking structure and all of that kind of stuff. So that's how the events will go. We are going to be increasing the purse sizes. We are going to be growing the speed golf course network. So in 2022, our goal is to have 100 golf courses in our network by the end of the year. Hopefully we blow that away, but that would be, we feel like, a good goal in 2022 to reach. So it's increasing the supply. So do we have a ton of demand right now? We have latent demand. So we have untapped demand. We have demand that people don't even know there's demand inside of them for it. And we're not going to tell them yet, because the first question people always ask is, what is speed golf? How do you play? And the second question they ask is, where can I go play? So we don't have an answer for that. And so it's fun to be able to tell people about speed golf, but then when you tell them and you don't give them a chance to go actually do it, it's a major letdown. And so we're going to build up the course supply here in the US, and hopefully that this then sparks around the rest of the countries. They'll go, oh, well, if the US is doing it, we can do it too. So we'll be developing out those best practices for that and how it works. And then we'll generate the demand. And we'll do that through all the different marketing channels you can think of. But then at that point too, we'll also start working with influencers, paying influencers to go out and speed golf. And that, I think it'll just be very easy for us to create demand.
Do you think you would ever get to a point where, you know, you could persuade a PGA Tour golfer, you know, to give it a go and see how they do, in a way of just showing the world that actually speed golf involves a lot of athleticism? And if you ask a Brooks or a Bryson to, you know, to do 18 holes as fast as they can and what they'd shoot, surprise, surprise, they might not shoot so well, and they might not actually get around in under an hour.
Yeah, they may not, you know. And it's but you got, you know, you have guys like Joaquin Neiman that did it at East Lake. Every Sunday, it seems like now, every Sunday, the single on Sunday morning goes out and they play speed golf. And so in a sense, you know, I was talking to my brother the other day, and he goes, you know what? He goes, that's a big deal, man. Everyone's talking about it. He's not even into golf. And he's like, everyone was talking about Joaquin Neiman playing speed golf on Sunday, like, and how fast he played. So it is happening. Are we going to be able to pull people over into a Speak Golf USA event? Like, probably not. That's okay though. What we can do is we can put together eventually like made for TV events. You know, I'm already talking to sponsors right now about that. Who want to put in $50,000, $100,000, get a couple of PGA Tour guys to come out, a couple of Speed Golf guys to come out, some gals, and do a really fun, and it wouldn't be traditional, just 18 holes of Speed Golf. It would be lots of really cool, fun things that would involve Speed Golf as well. So those kinds of things, exhibitions, you know, building up that game, exhibitions and fun made for TV stuff. In the next 2 years, you'll see more Speed Golf content than you've seen in the last five, by far. And that's on purpose. And I'm already working with a group of like five or six guys here in the States. And we're going to, in a sense, start a production company. So we're all going to be strapping on now. Whenever we go out and play Speed Golf, we're going to be strapping on. We're going to have drones. We're going to have GoPros. We're going to have people following us. We're going to be at tournaments. We're going to have basically like a production strategy. And so you're going to see all that happen. I mean, honestly, I could just keep going on what's going to happen the next 5 years if you want. But I mean, it's every angle, it's every corner, it's hitting everything.
The focusing on the Olympics, and with a lot of the, you know, the people who play, you know, it is for a younger audience, and a lot of them are perhaps PGA professionals of some sort. Is part of your vision as well to get, you know, more inclusion in terms of, you know, women and girls into it, and as well, perhaps, you know, more people who might be over, you know, 35, 42. I know that obviously you set a world record, which we're going to come on to at your age. But, you know, a barrier for somebody who's over 40 could well be that, you know, I want it to be more like triathlon, where I'm only competing against my 5-year age group because I'm competitive and I want to compete against people that, you know, where it's more sort of apples, you know, versus apples, as opposed to competing against somebody who's a lot younger.
Inclusion in sport is so huge. Speed Golf has already proven that it is. And that's what the beautiful thing about it is, when you talk about that 35 and over, 40 and over, all the way up to say 55, even into 60, we're heavy in that market. Those are the people that are playing. Where we don't have a lot of people playing, and it kind of makes sense, is the younger age groups. Because when do you play Speed Golf? You know, you play Speed Golf first thing in the morning, sunrise, or you play it late at night. But I would say 90% of Speed Golf rounds are played early in the morning. And so for kids in high school, they have to be at school at sunrise, you know, how do they have time to go out and play Speed Golf and then get to school on time? That's kind of hard. College, not college golfers, but just generally speaking, people in college, you know, they're a little tight on budget. And also they're probably not waking up super early to go play Speed Golf. So I think those two things, it just has to do with essentially scheduling conflict of when Speed Golf can happen versus when I'm available to play it. But the reason why it's working with the older age groups is because they've lost the ability to play Speed Golf, but they have the disposable income, and we've created a time block for them in which they can do it. You know what I mean? We had a 73-year-old playing in the national championship this year, Jules DeCoster. I mean, he comes out and he runs around, and it's so amazing to see. You know, a 73-year-old playing, and then we have, you know, teenagers. We have 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds in Kentucky playing, and occasionally we'll allow a kid will bring a father will bring his son who's 12, and they'll say, "Can you go play 9 holes after everybody is Speed Golf? Let's just see." And so we did that at the national championship last year. So, and then women, it's been tough to get women into this sport, and so there is a perception barrier that we need to break. We need to understand it better. And we need to break through that.
And I think too, with at least in this country, with you know, girls, teenagers, it's not a particular popular sport for somebody who's athletic. And I have two daughters who are in university, and they're both elite athletes. And their view would be, why would I play a sport that's not a sport when I want to be a, you know, an elite triathlete or a rower or whatever the case may be? So just getting them into golf is the first barrier before you even think about Speed Golf.
Yeah. I mean, you're already pulling up like a smaller group of people when you're just talking about female golfers. much smaller group than, say, male golfers. So now, you know, and then trying to reach out to women that aren't golfers, now they're thinking, well, I've got to learn how to hit the ball good enough to get out there and actually play. So it's just going to take some time. But, you know, you've even got LPGA Tour players saying, hey, I think it's time that we had more serious discussions, or like, don't stop talking about pace of play until something happens, is basically what she said, is let's make a move on that. Let's do something. Let's start encouraging that as players. And so that's great to see. Lauren Kupp has been a huge ambassador for it. And she, you know, she's a college golf coach. And so I think a lot of the work she's doing, and a lot of the work that like head pros like Garrett Holt in Springfield are doing, a lot of their work they're doing with juniors, and even to an extent, some of the work I've done here in Houston with juniors, we're going to see the results of that in 10 years. You know what I mean? May not see a lot of that for now. So like at the junior level, probably a great idea is to really focus more on education and awareness, right? With that age group. Let's not spend a bunch of time and money trying to get them to play. Let's just inform them and let them know it's there. And that way, when they get out of college and they get through their 20s and all of a sudden they have a kid and they have a job and they're busy and they can't play golf anymore, I remember this thing, speed golf, all right? So anyways, we've got to work on getting more women involved in the sport. And you know, golf as an industry and as a whole has taken on, you know, that idea of inclusion and getting people of color involved. And man, speed golf couldn't be more all about that. You know, we want that to happen.
Before we touch on the Speed Golf Championship for 2021 in the U.S., which you participated in, and some interesting things happened. At a general level, now stepping back from Speed Golf USA, it's more about your experience of playing speed golf. What was the biggest adjustment for you in playing speed golf? And out of curiosity, what sort of effect did playing speed golf happen on your normal golf game?
The answer's easy for me. And we've talked enough about my golf story now where you would probably be able to surmise that my mental toughness was not there. So that's what I really struggled with, was the mind, fighting against the mind. And when there was no pressure, I could do amazing things on the golf course. When you introduce pressure, you know, and enough of it, then I would crumble. So when I started playing speed golf, you know, it's not even something you have to think about. It's not even something you have to try to make happen. It's just the act of putting your body under pressure actually releases your mind, the pressure from your mind. It's kind of interesting. But, and so putting your body under that aerobic stress, your mind starts thinking, it actually has to start thinking different thoughts. It has to start, your mind starts thinking, aren't you thirsty? Do you really want to run this hole? Are you going to stop? Mm-hmm. You know, you might overheat. It starts talking to you about different things.
And it probably quiets down a certain extent.
And then eventually it just shuts up. Yeah. Cause it's like, okay, obviously you're taking me on a run here and I'm going along for the ride. So then it just becomes very simple thoughts. Just, can I take the next step? Can I make it over the cart path there? Can I get to that hill? Can I get to that little bump? Can I make it to the green? Can I put this ball in the hole? I want the time to stop. I want this to be over. You know, I mean, it sounds harrowing. It sounds really bad, but this is just what's going on. That's only one part of your mind. You know, there's another part of your mind that's absolutely enthralled with the moment and exhilarated and alive and feeling so alive. And so that starts to come out a little bit more. So all the negative thoughts and the ideas about performance and what am I shooting and how good am I hitting the ball, all that goes away and it becomes more just about being in the present moment, in the experience. It's that place that all golfers are trying to get to, that people have written thousands of books about, you know, and how to train your mind and how to go out there and just really struggle, you know, to get your mind to pay attention and listen. And here we are, we found a simple way to do it for $20. Just go out and play fast, you know? So that was the biggest thing for me, was it shut my mind down. And I could let my true potential shine forth.
At this point, we discuss Scott's victory at the 2020 U.S. Championships and the lead up to the 2021 Championships.
2020 is a COVID year. We almost canceled the U.S. Champs, but Jamie Young calls me. And I reached out to him and he got back. He said, I'll help you. Let's do this. Let's do it up in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Do it in October. And he did a fantastic job. He ended up getting the 2020 Speed Golf USA Ambassador of the Year Award for it, just for continuing on this tournament. And so we went out there and like I did things before that tournament as a player that I hadn't done since I was a high school golfer. I had a journal. I wrote out my intentions. I put that I was going to win. I wrote out a note for what I was going to say after I won. Like these are things I hadn't done in ever or since I was a serious competitor in high school. And so I went out and I think after the first day I was in like fifth place. And but it was a pretty tightly packed group. And then I played a really great round on the final day. It was a very tough track. I shot 75 with just really tough greens. And I won in 2020 and I got my name on the trophy. So that was huge. And, so I was like, wow, well, what else do I have to accomplish, you know, as an athlete? And I'm like, I still want to win worlds and that world record's still out there. My focus as a tournament coordinator shifted also in 2019 from very difficult and challenging courses, which is speed golfers love. And it's like, it's great. It's a challenge, but to let's start finding golf courses that meet the minimum requirements for world record performances for sanctioning them. But let's get as close as we can to that and see if we can start challenging. And I didn't necessarily think it would me. Whenever I think about world records, I think about Hogan. I think about Hawk. I think about Reed. I don't think about Dolly, you know, like, but I hope that Dolly has a chance. You know what I mean? Like, I'm always like, if I have my best day, it could be me too, but I'm really thinking about those guys. So heading into this year, I had played last year in the Missouri Speed Golf Open. I had a great final round. I shot 72 in 42 minutes, my fastest round time ever. And I shot a couple over. And actually, you can go on YouTube and watch my entire round because Nick Evans recorded it and got every one of my shots. It's amazing. And I used that footage to actually break down my round second by second to understand exactly how much time I'm spending. And I time blocked it all out. It was amazing. But I used that to inform my training for the next month before I then went out in 2020 and won the US champs. And by the way, I had the fastest round time on day two in 2020. And I had the fastest total time for the tournament. Scott Dolly. I don't even know how that happened, but I was super proud of the tack that I had taken in taking advantage of this footage that I had and training the right way and figuring out that high intensity interval training, speed golf style is really what works, you know, essentially simulating speed golf while you're running. So anyways, 2021 comes around and I'm like, Garrett, we got to have the US champs here. It's a great venue. We could see a world record. I think just the idea that it's the US champs will cause people to lift their game. More so than if it's just the Missouri Speed Golf Open. And so he was like, I love it. Let's do it. So leading up to it, I had honestly a very disappointing competitive season. I finished third once. I had my worst tournament ever in Kentucky this year. You know, it was a summer. This summer, I would describe this summer as like the most unexpected summer that we've ever had. And in a difficult, challenging summer, we moved. Moving is one of the most
stressful things
absolutely you can do. We moved after 8 years. So you find things in corners of cabinets that you didn't realize you could find. But so we moved out, we moved into here. Then my wife's a wedding planner. And so we had a destination wedding that we had to go to. And so we couldn't clean our house and I couldn't train. And then I go to Kentucky. And on the Friday before the Saturday of the tournament, my brother-in-law calls me and tells me that my father-in-law passed away. Wow. And so that's the first parent of me and my wife that we lost. And it was totally unexpected. And it just took all the air out of me, you know? And I was like, I'm coming home, Natalie. And she said, you stay there, you play, you know, give it your best for Junie, her dad. And I did try my best, but it wasn't there. And I had a horrible tournament and I came home and I trained a little bit for New York because we were going to be playing a Donald Ross course called Tiujiga. And so I was like, well, I want to be ready for Donald Ross. Like, you know, I don't want to be totally not fit. But again, it was just not really intense training. And we went up there and Lauren Kupp, as you know, had an incredible performance. She shot 72 in 50 minutes and has a new American record for a women's record. And so that was really cool. She shot 72 the next day and in about the same time. So, you know, she now has the world record for low 36 hole, but I mean, shooting 144 out, you know, on those two courses is just incredible. But I went out, shot 73 at Tiujiga. So kind of showed some form. And then I shot 77 in Rome. And so again, the game wasn't totally there. And so I just started to like slowly as we got closer to the US champs and I realized that life was taking over and that I wasn't going to get to train the way I wanted. I really just started dropping my expectations and really a lot of the pressure that I normally would start putting on myself and I'm defending this year and I've got to defend and I've got to be in shape. Like a lot of that just went away and I went out and I started running and I started having just more fun running. And I started hitting balls and I just was hitting balls to hit different shots. And I wasn't, you know, I really just was like, I'm not going to win this year. And that's okay. You know, I'm not really probably going to play great, but I'm going to host a great tournament. You know, we're going to have a great championship. So that was my thought process leading up as an athlete, leading up into the tournament.
And then what happened on the day then, on the first day?
So the day of, you know, I have to step back again one more time and just talk about something else that I think made a big difference, which was about a week before the event, I had looked for flights and they were too much. And so I was just like, I've made the 10-hour drive before, I'll do it again by myself. Well, it was Labor Day weekend that we were having the event. And my kids were off of school that Friday and then the following Monday. And so like we're 10 days out from the tournament. And Nat's like, well, we don't want you to go. You know, we hate being apart. I hate being apart from my family. I keep it to a minimum. Well, she's like, they have off Friday. They have off Monday. We're going to come with you. I'm like, you are? This would be awesome. Let's go on a road trip. Like we couldn't go on a road trip this summer. And so it worked out where my family got to come mm-hmm. with me. And that really was yep. awesome to have them there with me. And so we woke up that morning real early, got there at, you know, 6 a.m. because I'm helping him set up. And he had shoved me way down the tee sheet because mm-hmm. I hadn't been performing very good and I'd been running slow. So I wasn't teeing off until, you know, the first tee time was at 7:30 and I think I was at like 7:54. So I got there at 6 and helped him set up. And Elliot, my middle son, came with me. He got up that early in the morning and decided to come with me, which I thought was cool. And he's like, Dad, I got to go back. I'm freezing. Like, I'm cold. Let's go back. The hotel's only 7 minutes away. Can we go back and get my pullover? And I'm like, no. And my wife was going to come with me and she decided to sleep in. Well, we go back and get it and everybody wakes up and they all get in the car and they come with me for the first round. And so I was just like, oh, it's cool. My kids are going to be there and, you know, and Nat's going to be there. And so I don't even have any time to essentially warm up. I have a weighted rubber golf club that you can swing that kind of helps you get warm up. I did that for like 10 seconds and, you know, what basically walked up to the tee and he said, you've got 1 minute, you know, and I walk up, put my tee in the ground and just kind of look around. They announced my name and I just was like, yep. Here we go. Took a few hard swings with the driver, you know, practice swings, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Psh. And I hit a great first drive. That was always a good feeling. And it went a little left into the bunker, but Nat takes off in her cart with two of the kids. And I have my scorekeeper and my son in another cart. And, you know, we're kind of off to the races. And I just, you know, I'll tell you something else that made a difference in terms of my attitude that day. Like I said, my expectations were very low. I had, in a sense, not given up, but given up in a good way. You know what I mean? I think you can use that phrase given up if you say it right, you know, if you mean the right thing. And I had given up in a good way. But the morning before, Jason Hawkins had, normally we play in the afternoon the day before, you play a regular round of golf and that's your practice round. And you go putt on the greens, each green for a few minutes and whatever. Well, Jason Hawkins does not like playing regular golf. He never plays regular golf. He plays like a scramble once or twice a year. And it's just brutal for him. So he said, guys, I'm going out Saturday morning. I'm not going to play full on speed golf, but I'm going to go out there and I'm going to jog. Saturday morning instead of meeting up with you guys. If anybody wants to come, like, I'll be there. So seven of us showed up that morning before to go out. And so he and I went out as a twosome, and then there was a threesome behind us and a twosome behind them. And we jogged, you know, and we conversational pace and talked about things. And he and I are usually talking about, we talk about a lot of things, but you know, we usually talk about like how to grow speed golf and what can we be doing. So he's such a passionate, you know, ambassador of the sport. In fact, he is 2021 co-ambassador, Speed Golf USA ambassador of the year, along with Lauren Cup. And so, but anyways, we went out and I mean, I made four birdies. He made three birdies in that round. We jogged around in 52 minutes. We had so much fun and it was so relaxed. And so I just thought, wow. And I went to bed that night and I thought, that's how I want to play tomorrow. I almost want to, like, that was 52 minutes. I don't want to feel like I'm out on the golf course, just like huffing and puffing and pushing myself and making it painful. I do want to go, I have to go faster than 52 minutes if I'm going to win, but I want it to feel like that, you know? And so that's really how I took off. I just basically, you know, I was real relaxed. I took off. I was intense in my purpose, you know, of getting out there and getting around. And I was, you know, understanding that it was a competition, but I just think a lot of that expectation and pressure and stress and all of that, that athletes normally put on themselves, I was able to let all that go. And so I, you know, I kind of made a mess of the first hole. It's a par five that's reachable with an 8-iron. Like, you should be able to birdie it. And I hit out of my bunker shot. I hit left of the green, and then I hit a pretty safe chip just to make sure I didn't make bogey. And I made par, and I thought, all right, move on. And got to the next hole, played it perfectly. But I had like an 8-footer for par. And that's usually where you struggle in speed golf. It's where you struggle in regular golf too. But, you know, most days you're not going to make your 8-footers. You know, you're all of them. You might make one or two. And so for me, I knew right then and there, like, okay, I really should have chipped it closer. Now I've got this 8-footer. This is going to kind of tell me how the day is going to go. And I had been working on my putting stroke. In fact, I had looked at an old video of myself on Instagram from like 2 years ago, and I saw my putting stroke, and I was like, huh. And so I went out and tried that putting stroke before the tournament, and it worked out really well. So I employed that. It was just basically a real short backstroke, almost like a pop. And I popped that thing, and it hit the flagstick and just went right down the middle of the cup. So I was like, okay, I'm feeling good. That gave me a little surge of energy. I go to the next hole. It's a par three. Same thing. I got to get up and down, and I do. I make like a 3-footer, so the putts are falling. And I just made par after par after par for six holes. We get to seven. Seven's just got trees down both sides of the fairway, and there's out of bounds left, and there's a road right there. And so it's just always for me been kind of, it tenses me up a little bit. And I got up on that tee, and I just said, hit the best drive of the day. And I did. I just ripped it right down the middle of the fairway. I had a little 50-yard chip, delicate chip. You know, when you're speed golfing, those delicate chips aren't easy, but 50-yard pitches. Pitched it to 6 feet, drained the putt. I'm one under, and I'm like, here we go. I had been talking to Nick Evans, who is a speed golfer. He plays, but he also brings his GoPro, and he's kind of like our first production guy. He gets all the videos, and he comes out, and he makes videos afterwards. So he and I were talking about, okay, look, we need to be communicating with people who have cameras, and that way, if anybody turns at nine in 20 minutes and they're around even par, then we need to get a camera on them because it could be a world record attempt. So I got to one under, I go to eight, I make a par, I go to nine. And this year I brought a hybrid with me. Last year I only had four clubs. I had driver, 8-iron, sandwich, putter. This year I brought a hybrid, and I couldn't reach in two. Last year I couldn't reach nine and two. This year I was able to reach it in two, and I got up and down. And I made like a 4-footer. So I basically made all of my putts that I needed to make on the front nine. And I'm 2 under. I'm turning it 2 under in about 20 minutes. So I'm thinking, let's go, man. It's not good enough for me. I'm not running fast enough. I don't think 68 is going to be enough for me because I can't run 40. So I got to keep going. I got to keep going down. Like, you can't chill out. And I tried to tell a few people as I'm running through the parking lot to the back nine, like, I'm 2 under. Like, let other people know so we can get a camera on it. anyways, so I go to 10. 10 is a par three that's like 175. I can't hit it with my 8-iron. And I just, I always have to kind of aim right, hit a draw, hit a big hook in there. And I've never hit it. And I hit it on that day. And so I was like, it's another little thing while you're playing. You know, you're making all your putts. You're getting the good breaks. You hit the green on 10 and you're like, wow, I've never done that. This is a good day. Like something's happening. You start to believe in it. You know what I mean? And you start to really believe in the story. And so good two putt there. I hit a good drive out on the next hole. I had a very makeable putt up the hill from like 10 feet and I just barely missed it left on 11. I had a makeable putt on 12 that I hit. It's like almost went in and my wife's there, you know, come on, Scott, get to the next hole. Let's go. She's pushing me. I tell you what, having the family there and they're all just yelling and it's now you're getting into the place of a round and a speed golf round where you're hitting kind of like a valley. It's the point of determination, whether you're going to push through or you're going to let the day kind of win and you're just going to finish, you know, and it's a par five. I hit a terrible drive. So there's no way I was going to reach the green in two, which I'm fine with. And I just thought, okay, I can hit a good third shot up there, but I ended up in a greenside bunker in two. And I hit a bunker shot out to about 6 inches and I didn't see it stop. I hit it and I turned around to rake and I hear my wife going, yeah. And I look and it's like 6 inches. So here I am 3 under through 13. Okay. Now it's looking good, you know, but I'm just totally in the zone at this point. I'm in the moment. I'm enjoying it. I'm having fun. I'm realizing something special is happening, but I'm not wanting to get in the way. And so bomb a drive on 14 and I catch up with this, I don't know who it is, but I catch up with somebody on 14, which is very rare for me. And right as they run off the green, I'm hitting my second shot and I'm like, okay, I need to try to birdie this hole so I can get to the next tee box before they take off. And I got about 12 feet up the hill. I hit a firm putt and it just hits the back of the stick and goes in. So now I'm 4 under through 14. And I'm so tired and you're pushing yourself, but you're trying to do the math at the same time. Math while you're playing speed golf is not easy at all. It's very hard to do. So I'm like, wait a minute. Okay. So 66, if I can shoot 66, what is the time frame I need to come in? It needs to be like 42 under, you know, under 43. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm fast enough right now. I haven't been training. I don't know what's good. So I said, I just need to keep hitting good shots and try to get more under par. I pass the player. We're running up 15 together, basically. And I get out to my ball, which I had ripped a drive on 15, but I get out to the ball and I'm in the rough just left of the fairway, but I'm in a divot in the rough, like a full on massive divot. And my ball's right in the middle of it. And I basically just hit down on it. I end up next to the green. I chip up to 6 inches. Okay. We got one par checked off. Now we got three holes to go, 16. And now all of a sudden I got Hawk, you know, I see these people starting to show up to watch who finished their round, Luther Olsen and Hawk. And here comes Nick Evans with the camera. And I hit a hook into the rough on 16. And I hit the worst shot of the day on my next shot. I had to chip a little 8-iron and I was in the rough and I hit it poorly. And it came out, ended up on the front of the green, short of the front of the green. I had like probably a 50-foot chip. And so again, it's kind of the next challenge of that round. Can I get through this? Am I going to give in? Am I going to let the pressure of being 4 under allow me to make a bogey? No. I hit a good chip. I had about 6 feet. The putt was outside left. And I just give it a good roll and it goes right in the heart. And now we have video for this. So you'll be able to go watch this. We've got video from 16 fairway on. So I run up to 17. Rip a drive on 17, hit it just short on the front of the green. 17 last year is where I three putted from like 12 feet. And so I really wanted revenge on 17. And I say these little things just so you know, this is what's going on in somebody's round while they're playing. They are thinking about the past and like, you know, moments that have already happened and all that kind of stuff. So I get to 17 green and I have a long putt that I could three putt. And my first putt ends up about 7 feet short. And I'm like, oh man. And I thought about that putt last year and I said, I'm going to get you back. And so I took my time. It was a right to left putt and I just put it right in the heart and it was beautiful. And I'm like, okay, I'm bogey free going into the final hole. To me, it's an easy hole. Like it's same thing. You can drive it up to 50 yards. And Nick's there with the camera and he's like, let's go make speed golf history. And so now I'm kind of getting into that whole thing. Like, I don't know if I'm running fast enough, but I think I'm making speed golf history right now. And I get to 18T and I'm like, you're going to hit the best drive of the day right here. And it just center of the face. I ripped it right at my target, right towards the green. And I run down there and everyone's down there. I find the ball. I'm 50 yards out. The pin's probably 20 feet onto the green. And you have to land it short of the front of the green because it's going to roll back there. And I had told Nick, he goes, two more shots, man. You just got to hit two more shots. And I said, how about one more shot? And he's like, yeah, man. So I get up there, I hit it, and you can see it. It lands, it rolls probably 6 inches to the right of the flag. It was perfect speed to go in, but I got about 10 feet. And now that I'm on the green and I'm putting for birdie, I know I've got 66 in the bag. And so I'm like, it could be a world record. I think it probably is, but I don't know my time. And so it's just, and then I stepped up in the moment. I had 10 feet to make a putt on 18 that meant something. And it's like, that's all as a golfer you ever want. It doesn't really matter what it's for. Like, you just want to have to make a putt on 18. And so that's the mindset I approached with. And I kind of knew it was inside left. And I aimed my putter inside left and I said, just give it a nice aggressive stroke, you know, and it's gonna break. Trust it. And I put a good roll on it and about 6 inches out, I knew it was in, and I just turned away and dropped my putter and I gave a roar that was
I've seen that celebration.
decades in the making, you know, to be able to accomplish something.
Yeah. And did you know you knew at that split second when it went in that you had the record?
No, I still was not. I wasn't 100% sure that I had the record, but I knew I was close. Because you know, out on the golf course, you don't know your time. And so that again, I've said it like 5 or 6 times, but I mean, I just didn't know. I didn't know how fast I was. I figured I could do 45 minutes. So I thought 65 and 45, that's not enough, you know? And so I really didn't know if I set the record, but I knew I shot 65, and that to me was like with no bogeys, and I had made every putt I wanted to make. And so for me, that was the roar coming out.
And I think the last record was 16 years previously, which coincidentally was also a 65. And maybe that was in your mind as well. I don't know if you appreciated that, but it was, I mean, obviously the, you know, going low helps a lot because it's easier. You know, it's better to go low than to cut, you know, 7 minutes off your 10K time. That takes a little bit longer to, you know, to do that.
Yeah, effort-wise, it's much easier just to make the 8-footers than to have to run, you know, an extra 60 seconds faster.
But your stats for the day, I think you were 13 greens in regulation. You got up and down for the 5 greens you didn't hit in regulation, and you had 26 putts. And as you already mentioned, the short game can be the big issue, particularly if it's first thing in the morning and your hands are cold and all the blood is going to your, you know, to your body and your legs, not necessarily to your fingertips. It's not easy.
It's not. I feel in a sense that's why that short backstroke really helped, because yeah, you're out there trying to having really good rhythm on a putt, and you know, while your hands are shaking and blood's coursing through your body, I really feel like that putting stroke of the short back and just kind of a nice pop through to the hole, which it allowed me to be very confident in my stroke, you know what I mean? And so I think that was helpful. And then again, you just start seeing them go in, and then you start believing they can all go in, and then it's a round where they all go in. And so we walked off the green. You might have seen that part as well. And we're talking 108.56. And by the way, you did mention the record 16 years earlier, but I must mention that in Australia in 2016 at the Australian Speed Golf Championships, Mitch Williamson did shoot 77, 31 minutes and 56 seconds. And I believe Christopher Smith's record, which was at Jackson Park in 2005, was a 65 in 44 minutes and 6 seconds. And so he really only beat it by like 10 seconds, something like that, 10, 11, or 12 seconds, Mitch did. But because Guinness wasn't there, it wasn't considered official. I have problems with that. And I'm, you know, for me, what's going to be important moving forward is that the ISGA approves a world record attempt and not Guinness, because we're an official governing body. And that's what's important. Not necessarily, I'm not saying Guinness is gimmicky. It's they have world records, but.
And if you aspire to be an Olympic sport, I mean, Guinness, to my knowledge, doesn't have any involvement in world records on in track and field.
Correct. Yeah. So Mitch's record in my mind was standing. That was the one. And so I just knew I needed to be 108.56. So it was all about time at that point. Okay. I shot 65. So what does that mean? That means 43 minutes and 56 seconds. You know, okay, are we there? And we ask Garrett's wife, Shannon. She does the scorekeeping every year in Missouri. And we said, Shannon, what was the time? And she said, she goes, it was 42.15. And we just kind of all looked at each other. And Hawk goes, that's it. That's it. I said, that's it. I did it. And I just kind of bent over and I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did it. I just can't believe I did it. And I still have a sense of that right now. And I decided at that time, I just said, you know what? It's easy to go, well, what's the next thing? What's the next record? What are you going to do next? And if there was cameras there, that's what they would have said. Wow, you set the record. What's next? It's like, I'm going to enjoy this for a while. You know, I don't know how long it's going to last. And because the last record, you know, it took 10 years to break Chris's, and it took 5 years to break Mitch's. Is it going to take 2.5 years to break mine? You know what I mean? And then will it take a year to break the next one? Probably. That's how this sport is going. And as more people get involved in it, and as we trend on the side of playing courses that are closer to 4 miles in total distance and 6,100 yards, I mean, and you get better players playing, you know. So I'm enjoying this, and I'm waiting as long as I can to start having more, creating more goals for myself as an athlete. But I have thought, you know, yes, there was this putt that I missed and that putt that I missed. And if I was training, I would have run 2 minutes faster. And so 107 could have turned into 105. Could have been a 103. So that's possible. Mm-hmm. So I know now 103 is possible, you know, and it's like, okay, is 100 possible, you know? And that's, I think that's kind of definitely the holy grail of speed golf is, can we get somebody out there to shoot, you know, 64 in 35 mm-hmm. minutes,
you the know, equivalent of a 4 minute mile or a 2 hour marathon. Like, yeah. Yeah,
it's truly Olympic, isn't it? That idea of breaking 100 with score and time, that is an Olympic idea. And look, here's the thing. I'm a father of three. I have a job. I'm an amateur. I am a professional speed golfer, but in a sense, I'm not a full-time athlete. Wait until somebody wakes up every day and their job is to be a great speed golfer, to be the greatest speed golfer. I mean, we're going to see some amazing things. And that's, again, that's a decade away from now. But anyways, the record was, it's just so fulfilling to not only be pioneering the sport and to be an entrepreneur and to help create the economy around speed golf and to create goods and products and services and the marketplace. All of that, I love doing all that. But then to get a chance to be an athlete and to get my name up on some of these trophies and to know that when these trophies are being passed around 100 years from now, there my name will be. Now that part's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing journey from, as you say, the time from, you know, picking up golf as a child, playing with your father, to your college years and you know, some of the issues you had in college, but to overcome all that and where you are right now, it's a pretty amazing story.
I feel very blessed to have lived the life I've lived, and it's a life of a testimony. You know, it's a life of, and that's the beautiful part of it. It is about redemption. It is about being your worst and being saved, you know, and asking for help and receiving that help, and then really understanding that the sky is the limit. You know, the sky's the limit, and anything is possible with enough time. And, you know, if you don't give up, I've been wanting to do something like that. I didn't necessarily know it was the speed golf world record that I would be doing, but I've wanted to have a round like the one we just discussed my whole life. And then as a speed golfer, I've been wanting to have that round, you know, since I started playing in 2013. And so that's a long journey from 2013 to 2021 to not give up. And when did it happen? It happened when I least expected it, you know? And so that's the other thing is, if you love something, just do it and don't quit doing it. And when you least expect it, the thing you've always dreamed of will come to pass. Yeah, the other thing I would like to say is that I'm passionate as an athlete, I'm passionate as an entrepreneur, but I'm also very passionate about this community and about something we call the spirit of speed golf. And it was something that was at SGI, and it's something that we've carried forward. We exist in a community where we are inclusive and we do invite anybody to come in. You know, take Jason Hawkins, for example. You know, this guy wants to win the national championship, be the first, second time winner of it. I mean, he's got his own goals for winning the national championship. And he's out on the golf course on 16, 17, and 18, pushing me to play better, to go faster. You know, on 16, he said, how many under are you? I said, I'm four down. He goes, great, let's keep going. And then on 17, I hit my second shot. He goes, pick up your clubs. Let's go, move. Like, you know, so, you know, we exist in this community that competition is important, but we all want each other to perform at our best. We all want each other to win in the strangest way. Like whoever wins, we all win, you know? And so I look forward to continuing that spirit forward. And I know it will be challenged in years to come as there's more money involved in the sport and it becomes more commercialized and all that kind of stuff. I just want everyone to know that this is a really special community that is one that I'm fostering and nurturing. It's not one that I created. It's one that was created many, many years ago, but it's very special what we have. And I'm very thankful to be a part of it and to have the opportunity and to have the influence that I have in this sport.
So finishing up with some rapid fire questions, Scott, what has been your wildest golf experience or adventure, whatever definition of wild you'd like to use?
I would say my wildest golf experience was being invited to go to Alaska. And I invited Ari Crum, who came with me, and Ari Crum's dad, Tom. And we flew up to Anchorage, Alaska, and we had a chance to put on a speed golf tournament, which was helping to raise money for a local charity out there. And we were playing speed golf at 8:30 at night. And it was the most amazing, wildest experience on a golf course I've ever had. It was so much fun. It was really the first time that I'd played pairs speed golf. And I was doing it with the world champion, and we're out in Alaska with the beautiful mountains, and it's like supposed to be dark out, but yet it looks like it's 2:30 in the afternoon. And, you know, all these other people that are out there playing are having a blast, and we have all these Sun Mountain speed golf bags. And it was just, I can just close my eyes and go back. It was probably the wildest golfing experience I've ever had.
Cool. And where would you go for your own personal golfing pilgrimage?
I must go to the home of golf because I've never been. But yeah, that's where I'd go. I'd come over to the UK and Scotland and Ireland, and I would just spend a whole summer there. That would be the dream trip.
And Scott, what's your biggest passion outside of your golf and all the training that you do and everything you do with Speed Golf USA?
My greatest passion is being a dad. And along with that means being a great husband as well. But being a family man is something that I'm super passionate about. So, we've adjusted our lifestyle to accommodate that, you know, to so that both Natalie and I have been here for our kids almost every night of their life to put them to bed. And that's what we wanted, you know? And so we've missed out on other opportunities and other things, and we could have made more money and we could have a bigger house and we could have a better car. But, you know, this is what we chose. And it's because we're both passionate about being parents and just about having a strong family unit.
Lastly, if you could fly a banner around the world behind an eco-friendly plane, what would your message to the world be?
I mean, to put it simply, just, you know, have faith, believe in God. I think that's enough there. If people did those two things, I think then you could attach all kinds of other words to that. But that's what I'd say.
Great. Thanks for sharing that. Scott, thank you for coming on the podcast, being so generous with your time and sharing your your amazing story.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure, and it's great to listen to your podcast. And I look forward to hearing this one whenever it comes out, and sharing it around. And I appreciate you letting me share my story.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Wild Golf Podcast with Scott Dolly. If you like this episode, please tell your friends and leave a review on your favorite podcasting service. My guest next week is Susie Myers, one of the top teaching professionals in the United States and author of Golf from Point A.